us on politics or pedagogy.
Thank you, John. It was fun.
This is John Crumshaw with a special Politics or Pedagogy Education Report.
On KPFK, you hear more than a soundbite. That's education. That's our mission.
And please do support KPFK, your local radio station powered by the people. Make your contribution online at kpfk.org. Call 818-985-5735 and press 2 to become a sustaining member.
Join us this Tuesday on Global Village with special guest Bootsy Collins. Call your cousin, call your aunt, call your friends. Let them know that Bootsy's going to be on the air on KPFK Tuesday, June 3rd from 11 a.m. till 2 p.m. From Bootsy's Rubber Band and James Brown, Bootsy Collins behind songs like Flashlight, Parliament Funkadelic, One Nation Under Groove, Knee Deep. We'll be talking about Bootsy's latest LP, Album of the Year, Number One Funketeer.
Bootsy blasting up in your ear. I'm your number one funketeer, giving you the album of the year.
Don't forget, this Tuesday, June 3rd, from 11 to 2 p.m., Bootsy Collins on Global Village with Gary Baca.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Good afternoon and welcome to Middle East in Focus. I'm Negwa Ibrahim. Donald Trump recently completed his brief tour of Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, the first of his second term in office. And strikingly missing from the Trump administration's tour was a side trip to Israel or any evident consultations with the government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Instead, Israel was frozen out and actually blindsided by Trump's pronouncements. And while there were some important announcements made during this tour, the big announcements from Trump and the leaders of Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates did not include any measures to stop the genocide in Gaza and did not even mention the escalation of ethnic cleansing in the West Bank or Israel's recent decision on land registration, which amounts to full annexation of more than half the West Bank. In fact, Trump's silence on Palestine shows that while the administration might be cutting Israel out of its broader regional policymaking, it is not interested in pushing Israel on what it considers internal matters like the genocide in Gaza, the ethnic cleansing and annexation of the West Bank, and the occupation and apartheid in general. So with us today is Juan Cole to talk about Trump's trip to Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, the policy announcements that came out of that trip, and how while the Trump administration might be cutting Israel out of its broader regional policymaking, it is not interested in pushing Israel on what it considers internal matters like the genocide in Gaza, the ethnic cleansing and annexation of the West Bank, and the occupation and apartheid in general. Juan Cole is a Tom Dispatch regular and is the Richard P. Mitchell Collegiate Professor of History at the University of Michigan. His latest book is Peace Movements in Islam. His award-winning blog is Informed Comment. He is also a non-resident fellow of the Center for Conflict and Humanitarian Studies in Doha and of Democracy for the Arab World Now. Welcome, Juan Cole, to Middle East in Focus.
Thanks so much, Negwa.
I am so happy that you can join us today. I've been definitely wanting to have you come on our show for a while. So thank you so much for joining us to talk about this very, very important conversation that hopefully should highlight some things that are probably not being talked about enough within broader media as a whole. So first, let's talk about Trump's trip to Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and United Arab Emirates, and specifically what was offered by the governments of these three countries in investments and opportunities for the Trump Organization and American companies.
Well, a lot of the announcements had to do with arms sales. U.S. arms industry. And many of these industries, you know, make more than one thing. So Boeing is an arms company, but it also makes airplanes. And Lockheed Martin, likewise, has many products. But they offered to buy hundreds of billions of dollars collectively of U.S. arms from these companies. That's a win for the corporate sector in the United States. It's a win for the workers who work for those companies, mainly on the West Coast. And that's a very typical kind of announcement that you would have from a U.S. president visiting those countries. They're small. They have small populations. They're fabulously wealthy. Saddam Hussein showed in 1990 that another regional country could just walk in and take over any of them, as he took over Kuwait when he was dictator of Iraq. And so they're afraid for their security, these arms, and just the fact of a good relationship with the United States helps reassure the ruling houses in these countries that they have some a security umbrella from the U.S.
So Juan, just to clarify then, the investments and opportunities for American companies are specifically weapons manufacturing American companies? Is that right? Is that what you're saying?
I would say mainly. Okay. I mean, there were kind of vague announcements that these countries would invest in the United States. Saudi Arabia in particular seemed, and the United Arab Emirates, seemed to be interested in investing in a large language model or artificial intelligence sector. So this could be a boon, for instance, of liquidity for ChatGPT or NVIDIA, for instance. So there were some statements to that effect, but the specifics that came out that I saw mainly had to do with arms. And then, as you mentioned, there were side deals for the Trump organization. So there's going to be a Trump Tower in Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. There were, and those deals weren't always announced with specifics, but Trump and his organization will come out of this trip with its nest feathered.
So I want to ask a few more questions on this, and then we'll move on. So I know you talked about, for example, deals around possibly creating a Trump Tower in Dubai. Can you talk a little bit about also investment opportunities that were promised for that were given or promised for Jared Kushner's company?
That's not the kind of thing that they openly announced, but we've already seen. After Trump went out of office the last time, Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, formed an investment company and took people's money to manage it. Kushner, by the way, has no credentials or background in that field. But because of being a Trump in-law, he was able to $600 million in investments in this firm. But then Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, took money from the Saudi Sovereign Investment Fund and dropped $2 billion on Jared Kushner's firm. Some Democratic congressmen urged that there be an investigation of this deal as a form of corruption, but there never was. I think it's implicit in these friendships that Trump and his circle make in the Gulf that there will be quid pro quos.
So that leads me to my next question. How is this legal? Considering that, you know, Trump is president of the United States, using his position as president to further advance his wealth, his own personal wealth, as well as the wealth of his family and inner circle?
Well, Negwa, as we have discovered, Trump and his people constantly test the boundaries of the rule of law. They don't like the rule of law when it gets in their way, and they try to see if they can just dismiss the law. So far, Trump has gotten away with this way of proceeding. Technically speaking, I'm not an attorney, but as I understand it as a layman, in order for some of these side deals to be illegal, you'd have to be able to demonstrate that it's a bribe, that there was a specific ask for which emoluments were offered. Beyond that, there is an emolument clause in the Constitution, which I think is even more important than whether it's a bribe, forbidding the president to take emoluments, whether they're formally found to be bribes or not. So not only is it illegal, but probably unconstitutional. However, previous presidents, and not only presidents, but people in the government, just government employees, have had to divest themselves of any emoluments they received while in office, and had to be very careful with their accounts in case there was a Department of Justice investigation. But we all know that this Department of Justice is not going to investigate Trump, and he seems to think that he can get away with all this. Even once he goes out of office, nothing bad will happen to him.
Well, we'll definitely have to wait and see. So hopefully justice does prevail. But moving on, there's so many other questions I have, and we might not get to all of them. But one of the things that you state in your piece is that the plutocrats of Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates are looking to reshape the region from Libya to Sudan, Egypt to Syria, and are hungrily eyeing new investment opportunities in areas like the emerging artificial intelligence industry. The one question that I am going to put a pin in, hopefully maybe when we bring you back we can talk in more detail, is this issue around the artificial intelligence industry and how the governments of these countries are looking to get more involved in that industry and work with the administration to do that. Because I want to get into some of the other questions and issues that are really important. So we'll put that to the side for now. If we have time at the end, maybe we'll come back to it. Can you specifically talk about how the plutocrats of Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and United Arab Emirates are looking to reshape the region from Libya to Sudan? And how are they looking to do that with the Trump administration?
Well, they, you know, have been doing it for a while now. You know, Negwa, when I was many, many decades ago, when I was young and getting into the Middle East field, you thought about what was the important country in the Middle East. It was Egypt. Why? Egypt has a large population compared to many other Arab countries, which are relatively small. And it was industrializing at a fast clip under Abdel Nasser. It had a big army and a well-equipped army. So all of those tell you that a country is important. And those Gulf countries at the time, you know, the oil was starting to come in and they were starting to be better off, but they had come from a time when they had been desperately poor. But then in the 70s, you had the oil price revolution, the price of petroleum quadrupled, and then it remained historically high off and on beyond that, and the money just started piling up in these places. The United Arab Emirates is a postage stamp country. It has 1 million citizens, 8 million guest workers, has a sovereign wealth fund of $2.2 trillion. And that's not counting its currency reserves on top of that. So what I've seen happen in the past really decade and a half is that they've started to be less timid because they're small countries, but they've started to try to use their wealth to shape their region. And, the Arab Spring Youth Revolution in Egypt, which overthrew the dictator Hosni Mubarak, you know, witnessed a counter-revolution when Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, the field marshal, seized power made himself president for life. Well, I don't really know if he could have managed to pull that off and that the officer corps could have come back in that way, except that the United Arab Emirates dropped billions, I mean, $8 billion more than once, tranches of billions on Egypt to stabilize the economy and help the officers survive. And the UAE did that because it likes nationalist regimes. It doesn't like Muslim fundamentalist ones. And the Muslim Brotherhood had briefly come to power in Egypt, which the United Arab Emirates really objected to. And so I think they coordinated with the officer corps to crush the Brotherhood and to establish a more nationalist government. You take a place like Libya, the United Arab Emirates and Egypt have cooperated to ensure that Eastern Libya has a nationalist at its head. Western Libya is more influenced by Turkey and Qatar, and they like the Muslim fundamentalist movements. So Libya has had a civil war. It's politically divided. But if you look at why, it's not only that the Libyans disagree about policy, but they have international backers who use them as proxies. And the Sudan, the same. Only the situation in Sudan is much more dire than any place else in the region. It's the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, and it's partly a struggle between the Janjaweed militia, backed by the United Arab Emirates, and an officer corps which tilts towards Muslim fundamentalism. So that's one of the big divides in the region: is whether a government is formed through political Islam or has more nationalist emphases, and we see this in Syria now, where it's the one place where the Muslim fundamentalists have won. Qatar and Turkey have come out on top. The United Arab Emirates lost that one.
So you actually answered my follow-up question, which is really how are these countries, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and UAE, looking to reshape? First, I was asking about Libya to Sudan, and then my follow-up was going to be from Egypt to Syria. So you covered that. So now, though, how is Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and UAE looking to reshape the region from Libya to Sudan, Egypt to Syria, as you described just now, with the Trump administration?
Sure. Well, they need the Trump administration because the United States has a third of humanity under sanctions. There's an Office of Foreign Asset Control, OFAC, in the Department of the Treasury, which sounds like an obscure department, but actually controls the lives of a third of humanity. Because the United States Congress often does not have the gumption to actually do anything about policies in other countries that they don't like. And so they slap sanctions on those countries. Countrywide sanctions, usually. Sometimes they will target individuals. But a lot of the times these sanctions are on regimes, but the people suffer. So they had sanctions on Sudan. They had sanctions on Syria. And it late last fall, the Syrian government was overthrown. The government of Bashar al-Assad, which was a government that characterized itself as nationalist and socialist. It was probably neither. It was a brutal regime, and the U.S. had it under very severe sanctions, as did Europe. Well, you would think that if the government is overthrown and it was the government that was being sanctioned, that the sanctions would be lifted. But no, the sanctions hadn't been lifted because Europe and the United States wanted to use the prospect of sanctions relief to shape the Syrian government's policies. And so Mohammed bin Salman and Sheikh Tamim of Qatar, I think, went to Trump, and as did Tayyip Erdogan, the president of Turkey, and said, look, you know, these sanctions are preventing Syria from being reconstructed after a brutal civil war that, you know, made half the country homeless. They need to be taken off. And I couldn't tell you why, but Trump, who usually is pretty hard-hearted, melted at this request and met with Ahmed al-Sharaa, the new president of Syria, and announced that the sanctions would be taken off. Actually, Trump can't do that because they're congressional sanctions, but the State Department can issue a six-month waiver and renew it. And so that's what Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, announced that he would do, is going to waive the Syrian sanctions. And now Qatar and Saudi Arabia and Turkey are announcing big investments in Syria, trying to put it back on its feet. And this is something, by the way, that Congress probably didn't want and that the Israeli government did not want. But Trump sided with the Gulf.
This is Middle East in Focus, and we are talking today with Juan Cole about Trump's trip to Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, the policy announcements that came out of that trip, and how, while the Trump administration might be cutting Israel out of its broader regional policymaking, it is not interested in pushing Israel on what it considers internal matters, like the genocide in Gaza, the ethnic cleansing and annexation of the West Bank, and the occupation and apartheid in general. And Juan Cole is a Tom Dispatch regular and is the Richard P. Mitchell Collegiate Professor of History at the University of Michigan. His latest book is Peace Movements in Islam, and he's award-winning blog is informed comment. Everyone check it out. He's also a non-resident fellow of the Center for Conflict and Humanitarian Studies in Doha and of Democracy for the Arab World Now. So let's actually now jump into how some of these announcements by the Trump administration from this trip sidelined Netanyahu and Netanyahu's government. And let's talk specifically now with respect to Syria. And as you just stated, and you stated in your piece, Netanyahu was not happy about Trump's announcement regarding lifting the sanctions on Syria. Can you talk about why Netanyahu was not happy about that and why that's seen as sidelining Netanyahu and his government?
Sure. Well, Israel views itself as weak and under siege. I think it's a misestimation on the part of those Israelis who hold those views, because Israel has emerged as a kind of regional hegemon in the a dominating country in the Levant. They bomb Lebanon at will. They've tamed the Egyptian officer corps, which doesn't dare say boo to them. Jordan has very close security relations with them. And so when the revolution happened in Syria late last fall, the first thing the Israelis did was to take advantage of the resulting chaos and weakness of the Syrian government and army to bomb the Syrian Navy in its port of Latakia, to bomb Syrian air bases and land army bases, to hit their anti-aircraft batteries, in a wide-ranging aerial bombardment campaign of the sort you would wage with a country with which you were at war. And then Israel invaded Syria, took and held Syrian territory, and took a dam that provides 40% of Syria's water, and continues to intervene on the ground in Syrian politics. The Minister of Finance, Bezalel Smotrich, has argued for marching on Damascus itself. So from a Syrian point of view, the Israelis look like unprovoked aggressors. When asked about this, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister, says, well, the new Syrian government is a hardline fundamentalist Muslim one. not so different in its ideology from Hamas, and that he's afraid that it will eventually attack Israel just as Hamas did. It's an extremely dishonest estimation on his part, because during the civil war, the Jabhat al-Nusra, the support front that was the guerrilla group led by Ahmad al-Sharaa, who's now come to power, was fighting the government of Bashar al-Assad, the Ba'athist government dictatorship. Israel gave Sharaa's groups support, and even brought wounded fighters over to Israel for medical treatment. So Israel has a long history with al-Sharaa, who hasn't threatened Israel. In fact, has said he would like a good relations with all his neighbors. So, as usual, Netanyahu's statements are extremely self-serving, and Trump remarkably just dismissed them all and did as he was asked by his Gulf friends.
So we don't have too much time in there left, and I still actually have a number of questions. So I'm going to stick to just the last two, and maybe you can incorporate some of the things specifically with respect to Iran, which I'll bring up right now. So how has Trump's foreign policy trip, this most recent one that we've been talking about, marked a stark pivot away from what had long been a neoconservative version of Middle Eastern policymaking in Washington, including the Trump administration's position on Iran and actually continuing to press for a new nuclear deal with Iran?
Sure. Well, I think the consensus in Washington, again, for at least 15 years, if not more, has been, and this is a bipartisan consensus, has been that the best outcome in the Middle East would be if you could get the Arabs, including the Gulf Arabs, to make peace treaties with Israel, have them trade with one another, build up both the Israeli and the Gulf armies and the other Arab armies, and then have them fight a war against Iran on behalf of the United States, use them as a proxy to overthrow the regime in Tehran. This trip, that vision was completely disregarded. Trump would like a new deal with Iran about its civilian nuclear enrichment program, and the Gulf Arabs, who had once been belligerent towards Iran, have decided that they need peace in the region. They need good relations with Iran, and they want Trump to make a deal with Iran. So this is the opposite of Netanyahu's desire for war on Iran. It's the opposite of what I think most people in Congress and the national security establishment in Washington want.
And last question. Now, some might say, well, this sounds great, right? Lifting sanctions, for example, on Syria, that's affecting mostly innocent people and civilians, not making sure to do some sort of deal with Iran so that there isn't further escalation of violence or war in the region. So some might say this is great, but can you talk about how this is still deeply rooted in the Trump administration, really focused on what benefits Trump himself, not necessarily the United States as a whole, or even the Middle East as a whole, in terms of really creating policies for increased prosperity for both? And then can you also talk about how it's still, despite all of this, that it's still clear the Trump administration has not made and it seems unwilling to make the hard choices necessary to end the Israeli genocide of Palestinians?
Yeah, well, I think your last point is really important to stress. I mean, I think that the lifting of sanctions on Syria is good. And so the fact that Trump did it shouldn't influence us to think it's bad just because Trump did it. I agree with you that he probably had pecuniary motives for it, but why ever he did it, it's a good outcome. And sort of stepping back from a war footing with Iran, and if a new deal could be made, would be good. But you know, the region isn't just dominated by those issues. As you say, there's a genocide in Gaza. There's an extremist Israeli government that's attempting to annex the entirety of the West Bank. There are people who want to expel and ethnically cleanse 5 million Palestinians. And then, you know, Sudan, again, there's 16 million people.